and his latest book's Body of Secrets. And when I say notorious, no such agency, or the National Security Agency, who actually the three letters I think were just as classified as the NRO, for many, many years, does not like the covers pulled back. And this gentleman took the time to pull the covers back. A couple quick questions for you. One, after you published the book, did you get visited by the IRS?
No, I had worried about it, but no, they kept away. I didn't think I made enough money at first from the book that they bothered to come around. So,
did anyone in black suits with black glasses come to visit you?
No, NSA tried to put me in court twice, bring me to prosecute me twice, but they didn't succeed. So,
is it true that you were signing autographs in the commissary of the NSA?
Actually, I did sign autographs a couple months ago at NSA. Last time they tried to put me in jail. This time they had me up there for a book signing. So.
That's where they implant the DNA thing in the back of your head. Is it true, then, that they all get four-hour lunches over there?
Jack must have told you that, I guess. No, I don't think so.
Three-and-a-half-hour lunches?
That might be right, yeah.
Your tax dollars at work, folks. With that, I'm going to turn it over to him, and we'll see if we can't get the air conditioning fixed.
Thanks, Priest. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. Just to give you a little background here, I don't know how many people know that much about NSA. When I started out, I knew almost nothing about NSA. I graduated from law school and didn't want to practice law, so I thought I'd go into writing. There have been a lot of people that have written books on the CIA, so I didn't think I could really contribute anything there, but nobody had done anything on NSA. And when I started it back around 1980, when I started the Puzzle Palace, I was really amazed how few people actually knew about NSA. Later on, I was actually in a car with Senator Bradley, Bill Bradley from New Jersey, and we were riding to a talk show, and he was going to talk about the economy, I was going to talk about NSA, and he asked me what my book was about. And I said, it's about NSA, the National Security Agency, and he said, what's that? So I had to explain to the senator what NSA was, and when we got on the show, the host asked, first question he asked me was, how secret is NSA? And I said, well, even Senator Bradley said he had never known about it. And his aide called me the next day and said that was a really below-the-belt hit at the senator. And I said, well, it wasn't below the belt. It was the truth. And I said, if I wanted to hit him below the belt, I would have said that he probably confused it with the NBA. So the other thing, when I had the Puzzle Palace come out, I was very surprised going into bookstores. I'd ask for the book and see if it's in there where it's supposed to be, and I wouldn't see it a lot of times, and I'd say, don't you have the Puzzle Palace? And the clerk a lot of times would say, yes, it's right back there in the puzzle section. So that's one of the reasons I changed the book this time to Body of Secrets. One other, when the book came out, there was a Book of the Month Club picked it up, and all the authors, when you get picked up by Book of the Month Club, look at the little back of the New York Times magazine or back of the New York Times book review to see your little jacket back there. And when I looked back there, it said, they had the jacket and it said, The Puzzle Palace, a report on NASA, America's most secret agency. So the ad company thought I had made a mistake on my book since they had never heard of NSA. And they voluntarily changed NSA to NASA, NASA. So I probably sold a few extra copies to astronauts that week, but then they changed it. NSA today is, let me back up. When I wrote The Puzzle Palace, NSA was pretty much at its height. Vietnam War had ended soon before then, and they were really getting a lot of money from the Reagan administration. So it was really at its height, and it was also at its height in terms of secrecy. When I wrote the book, the purpose of my talk here today, what they asked me to talk about, is how I did the research. And to a large degree, researching a book like NSA on a very secret agency has some similarities to hacking. I mean, hackers and what I do are sort of similar in the sense we're both after forbidden information, information that's being kept from me and from everybody in terms of NSA. So the way I went about writing this book had to require some unique ways of doing research. One of the problems I had was that NSA is immune from the Freedom of Information Act. There's a thing called Public Law 8636, subsection 6, which I know by heart. If you send a Freedom of Information Act request to NSA requesting documents, they're going to send a letter back saying under Public Law 8636, subsection 6, we don't have to give you the information. And it was a law Congress made to immune NSA from the Freedom of Information Act. One of the things I did was I found an NSA newsletter. NSA has these newsletters that come out every month. And it's a newsletter that's fairly chatty, but it's very useful to somebody who's trying to find out what NSA is doing, trying to find out what's going on in there. But even though the newsletter was unclassified, NSA didn't have to give it out because it was came under this Public Law 8636. Well, in reading the newsletter, there was a little paragraph in it that said the contents of this newsletter must be kept within the small circle of NSA employees and their families. And that was sort of the key. By opening that newsletter up to family members, they basically opened it up to the world from a legal point of view. And I argued that with NSA, and NSA was very worried I was going to go to court. And if I did go to court, I think I would have won on that. But the general counsel called me up and asked me to come to NSA to sort of settle this out of court. And the way we settled it was I agreed not to ask for the names of employees below a certain level on the newsletters. And in return for that, I was going to ask for something like an interview or something. But I did have a long list of requests. I wanted a tour of the agency. I wanted interviews with senior officials. I wanted the entire internal structure, how the agency works, and going back for 5 years. And lo and behold, they gave me everything I asked for. I couldn't believe it. So they gave me the tour. They gave me the interviews and so forth. So that was one of the key ways of getting into NSA. And I really didn't give up anything because what they didn't realize was I had already found somebody else who had a whole collection of these old newsletters. I kept somebody that retired and kept all the old newsletters. So all the information I needed, I got from that from those newsletters that this guy I found had. So that was one of the key ways of getting into NSA, was finding a loophole in the Freedom of Information Act, and it was able to get me the tours and so forth. One of the other ways that I was able to get information out of NSA through the Freedom of Information Act was they had an investigation of NSA during the 1970s. NSA was involved in illegal eavesdropping for many years, eavesdropping on millions of communications. The Justice Department conducted an investigation in the mid-1970s and found out that NSA had been doing it for decades. They wrote up a report on the investigation, and I sent an FOI request in for that report. When NSA found out that the Justice Department actually released it to me, which I was very surprised at, they had taken a few things out of it, NSA and the Justice Department, or NSA, tried to get the document back. And that's when they threatened me with prosecution. They were going to prosecute me if I didn't give the document back. At one point, I had a meeting in Washington with the Justice Department and NSA, and they told me that the NSA, the Justice Department accidentally declassified it and politely asked for it back. And when I refused to give it back, we had another meeting. This went up in Boston. And that's when they brought up the threat of the espionage statute, because there is a portion of the espionage statute that says if you incidentally come into possession of classified documents and refuse to return them to their proper custodian, you could be prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And we still refuse to give the documents back. There is another little law called the Executive Order on Secrecy, which is an executive order of the president. And what that says is once a document's been declassified, it can't be reclassified. So we kept sending a letter back saying, you can't prosecute me under espionage because, first of all, I didn't commit espionage. Second of all, it was the Justice Department that released the documents to me in unclassified form in the first place. So they still sent letters back to me saying, you are currently in possession of classified documents and we demand their return, and we just kept sending our letters back. eventually they went away because, eventually what happened was President Reagan changed the executive order to say once a document's been declassified, it can be reclassified. But they couldn't apply it in my case because it would have been what's known as ex post facto. You can't create a law to prosecute somebody for doing something in the past. So that was one of my experiences with almost getting prosecuted by NSA. Another time was when I had to sort of go outside the box to try to find information on NSA. One of the other ways of doing it is looking for manuscript collections. That's where people leave their papers. If you're somebody's semi-famous and you want other people to write about you later on, you leave your papers to a university or something. And one of the key founders of NSA, William F. Friedman, left all his papers to the George C. Marshall Research Library, primarily to get him away from NSA. And after he died, all his papers were put down there. Well, NSA went down there and went through all his papers before anybody in the public would be able to get access to them. And again, these are public papers or private letters and so forth. So when I went down there and I started going through the papers, there were all these withdrawal slips, withdrawn at the request of NSA, withdrawn at the request of NSA. And I talked to the archivist down there and I said, look, Friedman put his papers down here to get him away from NSA, not to keep him, let NSA come up here and take the documents away. So I convinced the archivist to open the documents up to me. And he went to the vault and brought them all out and gave them to me. And I used them in the book. And NSA had no knowledge about that. And then at the time when I was doing this. And then we found out that the former director of NSA also left all his papers there, Marshall Carter. And I went through those papers. And NSA had never had access to those papers. And it was a wealth of information for the Puzzle Palace. A great deal of information that slipped through NSA's fingers, basically. When the book came out, NSA was furious because they never had any idea I would have access to this material. And they went down to the library, the George C. Marshall Research Library, and began ordering the library to, again, start taking all these documents out of the public domain, take them off the shelf and lock them again in the vault. And this time there was an enormous suit by the American Civil Liberties Union, the American Historical Association, the American Library Association. They all sued. Let me just shut this off. Sorry. They all sued NSA over the action because they said you can't go into a private library and start pulling private papers off shelves and locking them away. I mean, NSA at that time felt they were basically above the law. And they did it. The court suit that resulted ended up winning half the loaf. NSA won sort of half the suit, and the ACLU and the other groups won the other half. But it's a bad precedent, and today the law is still the same, that once a document's been declassified, the government can reclassify it years later, 10 years later or whatever. And so it's a real hardship for anybody trying to do books on secret agencies. After I did the Puzzle Palace, I went into journalism. I was a magazine writer for a while, and then I was the investigative producer for World News Tonight with Peter Jennings on ABC. I covered all the international and national scandals for the for ABC News, World News Tonight. And I can only take so much of that. When Monica came along, I thought it was time to leave, and that's when I went back and started writing again, and that's when I started my new book, Body of Secrets. Starting this book, the new book, Body of Secrets, was I had, just the same amount of trouble. I went to NSA. I said, I'm going to do a new book, and can I get some help? Can you give me some interviews? Can I get a little tour? Can I have a few documents or whatever? And again, it was this hardball approach. We're not going to help you. We're not going to give you anything. So I said, they didn't stop me last time. I'm just going to write the book. And, you didn't help me last time. I'm not going to expect you to help me now. I'm just going to keep writing it. But halfway through, about a year into it, or a year and a half into it, I got a call from NSA saying the director would like to have dinner with my wife and me. So all of a sudden, things changed. And General Hayden had come in the meantime, a new director, and we had a meeting, and they agreed to start opening up things to me that they hadn't opened up before. I got numerous tours through the agency. I got interviews with the director, interviews with senior officials. In terms of documents, they weren't going to be much help, but I, again, found new ways to use the Freedom of Information Act to get information from them. And this time, the newsletters weren't any good this time, since after my last book, they watered them down. There really wasn't much information. But this time, I found out that NSA did oral histories. They interviewed people in the agency, former directors and deputy directors. And these were all extremely secret documents. They were top secret, Umbra, code words, all these other things. But I requested, so I would have spent years trying to fight for these documents. But what I did was I requested all the unclassified pages, just the pages that were not classified. And or actually, what I requested was all the unclassified paragraphs, because they have to classify paragraph by paragraph. And I got maybe out of 100 pages, out of every 100 pages, I got maybe 20 pages. So when you're talking about a lot of oral histories, that was still a great deal of information, and it gave a great deal of information about what was going on inside NSA. Because although they weren't talking, they could keep away the information on the latest secret operation that they were doing, they had to leave in all the gossip, because that wasn't really classified. So you had directors talking about what they liked about this deputy director, or what they didn't like about the employees, or whatever. So you had all this great information that was useful for the book. One of the interesting things when you read those oral histories was the very first thing that the people being interviewed were usually very worried, and the person doing the interview in NSA, again, these are NSA people interviewing NSA people in NSA, and there was always this assurance at the very top of the document that, don't worry, whatever we say in here is never going to get out of NSA. Nobody will ever see these words again. And then it was very, and usually the last thing they asked whoever it was they were interviewing, for some reason, they always asked them, and what'd you think of the Puzzle Palace? And so I got a lot of comments from people in NSA on the Puzzle Palace. And again, this is one other way to sort of you know, hack into what NSA is doing. I mean, I had to use methods that are you know, fairly unique this time. Those are pretty much the ways I was able to get into NSA. The information that I got this time that sort of is new in this book that I didn't have in the last one, I get into the whole issue of Echelon a lot, which is, you know, in the news a lot. It's NSA's capability to eavesdrop on international communications. And a lot of the speculation in Europe, for example, is NSA's eavesdropping on commercial communications to pass on to U.S. Companies. In other words, stealing from Airbus in France, passing it on to Boeing or whatever. I've never found any indication of that, but there is very serious implications for privacy especially overseas, because the protections that apply to the United States citizens don't apply over there. So right now there's a committee in the European Parliament looking into this question of Echelon, what NSA's spying capabilities are. I also get into that in this new book. NSA's capabilities are really enormous. One of the former directors of NSA said in one of the documents that I got, he discussed NSA's signals intelligence capabilities, their eavesdropping capabilities. And one listening post alone, I mean, there's hundreds of listening posts around the world, one listening post alone has the capability of intercepting about 1 million, or actually one listening post has the capability of intercepting 2 million pieces of communications an hour. That's telephone calls, faxes, emails, internet communications, whatever. And the problem with that is somebody at some point has to analyze that information. It's got to go down to a human being someplace, somewhere, being able to actually listen to that information or read it. And so what they have are computerized filters that sort of filter out the information they don't want. These filters are looking for particular phone numbers, particular keywords. One example, if you're the Russians and you have the Russian SIGINT agency, for example, and you want to eavesdrop on Washington, one way to do it is you really only want the most important communications. And the way you would do it would be you intercept all the satellite communications in and out and all the microwave communications. It's not really that difficult. And Russia does it from Cuba. They've got the largest listening post in the world in Cuba. And it's in a place called Lourdes, Cuba. The way the filters work is if you want the most important communications, one of the things you do is you program it for particular phone numbers. And in the United States, in Washington, they make it easy to some degree. For example, if you want, you don't want Georgetown University students calling home for more money or whatever it is. You don't want, somebody calling up for a pizza delivery. What you want is NSA, you want CIA, you want the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon. Well, all the telephone numbers at the White House begin with the same prefix, 456. All the numbers at NSA begin with 688. So you'd program the computers to just pick up the prefixes for 456, 688, whatever they are at the State Department, whatever they are at the Pentagon. So that's one of the ways NSA reduces the amount of information it has to collect and just focuses on the important part. Once a listening post picks up about 2 million pieces of communications, these electronic filters reduce it to about 13,000 pieces of communications. And then the people in the listening post, like at Menwith Hill Station in England or wherever, will reduce it further to about 1,000 pieces of communications. And then that 1,000 will be sent to NSA, where analysts at NSA at Fort Meade outside Washington will reduce it to maybe the 10 most important pieces of communications. And out of that, there'll probably only be about 2 reports that will ever come out. So out of original input of about 2 million pieces of communications an hour, there's about 2 reports that actually will come out of that one listening post. So that's pretty much the way NSA is doing it today. It's a lot of microwave interception and satellite interception. The big problem they have today now is a lot of people are saying NSA is going deaf. It's because they the change in communications. NSA is reduced by about a third from 1990 in terms of the people that work there, and they've got a lot more communications they've got to deal with today. They've got to deal with, just to back up, 20 years ago, most written communications went in envelopes, sealed in envelopes that went through the mail. Today, I don't know about most, but a large percentage of the written communications goes through the air. They go in the form of email and faxes, computer transfers, whatever. So, 20 years ago, love letters, contracts, confidential contracts, business proposals, whatever it was, it went through the mail. And today, all that just goes through the ether, basically. And so NSA has a great deal more information available to it. Not only voice communications, but tremendous amounts of written communications. The problem that NSA has today is a lot of that communications is now going, instead of by satellite and microwave, it's going by fiber optics, which are far more difficult for NSA to tap into. These are basically light signals going through glass fibers. So it's much more difficult than eavesdropping on microwave and satellite communications. But NSA has found a way to do it, and they are able to do it. It's just not as economical for them. And the other problem is encryption. More and more people are getting into encryption these days, and NSA, as most of you know, fought for years during the 1990s to keep the amount of encryption, the quality of encryption low and the amount of encryption limited. And they largely lost that battle. But still, the NSA is still trying to, that is still a major problem for NSA. And encryption is spreading worldwide. And NSA is very worried that, not right now, but 5 years from now or 10 years from now, the key information that they're after is not going to be there anymore. And so those are the problems that's confronting NSA right now, and those are some of the new issues I get into in my new book. A couple other things that I get into are what NSA did in Vietnam, NSA's emphasis on the computer industry, what they've done in terms of building the computer industry and where they are now in terms of trying to prime the pump for still some supercomputer companies and so forth. So anyway, I take the NSA from the day World War II ends up until present, look at it during the Cold War. So that's just an overview, and I'll take any questions anybody might have here. Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, it's a good question. The question has to do with, you know, if they can each listening post might be able to pull in 2 million pieces of communications, but how much good are they at processing all that to be able to pick out the important information from the not important information? Actually, NSA is having a really big problem with that. For example, they totally missed the nuclear test in India. They missed the attack on the USS Cole. They missed the attacks on the U.S. embassies. And that is the key target for NSA now, is terrorism, now that the Soviet Union is gone and Russia's verging on a third world country. So terrorism's a big thing. And, if you talk to the people off the record at NSA, they say, yes, but you don't know about the times that we were able to prevent them, and we were able to prevent this and that and a number of other times. I mean, it's possible. I don't know whether they were able to prevent those or not. They don't talk publicly about them. But I do know the ones that they have missed. So the problem that they have is, again, drawing this huge amount of communications down to a level where there's actually human beings sitting in front of a computer and actually reading the messages or listening to it. And that's NSA's big problem. They do it with enormous computer power what basically is a fairly minimal amount of human beings. And the problem now with computers is NSA's computers are on the verge of collapsing. They did collapse about a year and a half ago, and NSA went deaf for a year and a half, and that's one of the other problems. Yes, sir. Okay. The question was NSA used to claim that it was the world's largest, or at least America's largest, employer of mathematicians and linguists and a couple other fields. And the question is whether that true today with all the downsizing? I think it's still true today. I'm almost positive that they are probably the world's largest employer of mathematicians today. And in terms of languages, they're probably at least the country's largest employer of linguists. And the problem they're having for linguists today is that with all the Russian linguists sort of out of work, they're looking for people that speak things like Lingala, Karen, and Creole, and all these other languages that are very hard to get. And that's, again, one more of NSA's problems today. Yes, sir. Uh-huh. The question was NSA employees, they are having this downsizing now, and the question is, where do you find these NSA employees if you want to hire them in your company or whatever? It's hard. I mean, you can actually put an ad in the paper and say, previous NSA experience desirable or something like that. There are probably an awful lot of employment services around the Laurel, Maryland area that have a lot of people in IT work and all kinds of computer work that would probably be available. So I think that's probably one way of doing it. Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. How do you split your time when you're doing research between talking to people, filing MOAs, and reading the output, and being in a library and looking up public documents?
The question was, how do I split my time between when I'm writing a book like this on between doing research, sending FOIAs, going to the library, look up documents, and and writing. It's hard to say. I actually used to like to doing the research better when I did the Puzzle Palace. It was a lot more fun and all that. Now I actually like the writing better. So the way I normally do it, I have to write with holes, basically, because it's difficult to write this kind of thing because you can't get all your information all at once. You can't go out and spend a year doing research and then spend a year doing writing, because you have to send FOIAs, and they may come a month or a year later. So I do sort of a little bit of everything all along, because you can never tell when you're going to get information. One other place I got a lot of information this time, I didn't get it last time, was through websites. Believe it or not, last time one of the hardest things was finding NSA people to talk. This time there's a lot of websites around for former listening posts and so forth. Former employees of these listening posts, they actually have their own website, and they list their names and they have email addresses there. And they actually put little letters in about what they did at their listening posts. So it was kind of amazing. Yes, sir. Where do I see the NSA going in the future? It's hard for me to say, since I'm always been this outsider looking in, but NSA right now has this program called Trailblazer, which is a program to do a lot of outsourcing. That's what they're doing now. They're trying to save money, and they're actually laying off a lot of employees and not hiring a lot of employees in order to outsource, to have contractors do a lot of work. I see NSA going in that direction. And the question is whether that'll work or not. Only time will tell. Yes, sir, back there. Well, the question had to do with the gentleman was at a listening post in Germany a number of years ago, and he noticed a lot of Seventh-day Adventists and other religious groups that were Well, that's an issue I don't really know the answer to. So I have to plead ignorance. But there is a obviously when you go to get a security clearance, it's going to narrow down the selection of people to people who haven't done heroin or something like that. And you are going to get a certain slice of society that you wouldn't get someplace else necessarily. Yes, sir. That is true. Yeah, I don't know. I've never looked into the religious persuasion of NSA employees, one compared to the other. But that is true. The Mormons would be, very qualified people, because they do go to missionary assignments to places and learn exotic languages, and that's one of the key things NSA is looking for right now. Yes, sir. Well, the question was there anything that I uncovered that the NSA asked me to release, and did I? I've never, ever had an agreement with NSA on anything. When the NSA did cooperate with me this time, I told them it was going to be a one-way street. You know, you're going to cooperate with me, but I'm not going to give you the book. You're going to get it at the same time everybody else gets the book when it comes out. So they never did ask me. They never reviewed either the Puzzle Palace or this book. So they never had an opportunity to ask me to take something out. Now, there are a couple of things I didn't put into the book, both Puzzle Palace and this one, because you're just using my own judgment. I didn't think, you know, didn't really add anything. And I did think there, you know, was a possibility. I cut off writing about actual code breaking, cryptanalysis at 20 years. So I don't write about any code breaking in the most recent 20-year period. I stop around 1979 or something like that. So, you know, I mean, that's just a personal judgment. But it wasn't anything NSA asked me to do. And if NSA had asked me to do it, I would have put it in the book. You know, so they never have. Yes, sir, in the back, right there. Uh-huh. Wait, let me. Yeah, the question was whether the laws are adequate, whether, in my opinion, the laws are adequate now for protecting people, you know, from NSA. NSA did have a long history of illegal eavesdropping, and the laws were changed in 1975 to put a legal structure around NSA. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And what it created, which... having graduated from law school, I'm still amazed most lawyers I bump into have never heard of it, but it's a thing called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's a secret court that was created in Washington, and even its location is supposed to be secret, although I'll tell you, it's on the top floor of the Justice Department building. And what this court is supposed to do is it gets the requests. If NSA wants to eavesdrop on an American citizen in the United States, it has to go to this court and get a warrant. It's a but it's a totally secret court, and the track record of the court, in NSA's perspective, is very good. In the 25 years since it was created, it has never once turned the government down on a case. And if the government ever does get turned down, there's a thing called the FISA Appeals Court, Foreign Intelligence Appeals Court. Which has a unique distinction of being the only court in the United States never to have heard a case. And then if that turns it down, there's a foreign intelligence, or they could get an in-camera session with the Supreme Court. So losing is not a likelihood. But basically, yeah, I think that's probably, the laws are probably adequate. I think they could be fine-tuned a little bit. There's a few things I would change. But basically, I think that's probably adequate. Today. Let me get a question over here. Yes, sir. The question is whether I think I ever got any disinformation, whether any of the information seemed a little too good. It's hard to tell. I mean, one of the things you do as a journalist, and one of the things intelligence people do, is they don't go to one source. They try to they get information from source A, you also try to check it out with source B and source C and so forth. So I don't, you know, I have no idea whether I got any disinformation. I don't think there was very much, if there was. A small amount. Okay, we'll have to talk about afterwards where it was, and I'll have to correct I think it's the 26th edition when it comes out. So yes, sir, let me take your question. The question is, how much outsourcing does NSA do with the military or through the military? I'm not sure exactly. The outsourcing I've been talking about is mostly reducing civilian employees at NSA, but I think they are reducing the number of military employees, too. They've closed down a great number of listening posts around the world, and they're trying to consolidate it, and the listening posts are mostly run by the military. And they've tried to consolidate them into smaller listening posts. And they've just closed, or they're just about to close, Bad Abling, which is a very huge listening post in Germany, for example. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question is on Bad Aibling. That's a very huge listening post in Germany that the NSA has operated for decades and decades, and the fact that it's closed now. Question is, you know, what's the real reason they're closing it? I think there's several reasons. One of them is they do want to consolidate these into one location. And if you're intercepting satellite communications, it doesn't really make much difference whether you're in Germany or England. So they're taking a lot of the people from Bad Aibling and putting them at Menwith Hill Station in England. But I think a second reason, as I think you probably brought up, is that there is all this bad publicity with Echelon now in Europe, and particularly in Germany, about NSA illegally eavesdropping on Europeans and so forth. So I think that's another factor that's gone into moving it out of Germany and putting it into England. England can't complain about it because England's part of the UK-USA agreement, the five countries that make up the intelligence sharing organization. Yes, sir, and I'll take yours. Yes, sir. You know, the question is, now that NSA is becoming more and more public, is there another agency that's assuming the role of, you know, the most secret agency or whatever, possibly the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office? Actually, the NRO has a better public profile than NSA does. I mean, in terms of putting out its message, having been in ABC for a long time, NRO has had me over there many times, and they've been, me as a journalist over there, and they're fairly open. They're more open than NSA. I write about this first signals intelligence satellite called GRAB in the in my new book, and there's a follow-on satellite called Poppy, which information on GRAB's been released, but information on Poppy is still being kept secret. The NRO wants to release this information. CIA wants to release the information. NSA is still withholding it. So NSA is still trying to keep as much secret as possible. Okay, let me take one last question. This gentleman over here. Yeah. Well, that is a problem. Now, the question is there a problem because when I find these loopholes, then they sew them up and no other researcher can find them afterwards? I mean, the problem is there aren't any other researchers. I did The Puzzle Palace, which was the first book on NSA, and I thought 5 years would go by and somebody else would do a book on NSA or whatever, and then 10 years went by and almost 20 years go by. And then I ended up doing it myself. But that is a problem. Yeah, I, you know, did the newsletters, and then the newsletters weren't any good anymore. I had to keep finding new ideas. So 20 years from now, I'll probably do the third of my trilogy, and I'll have to find some new ideas to get into the information. But I wanted to, Jack wanted me to make an announcement that I was going to be signing books. There's one of the booksellers is downstairs selling the book, and then anybody who wants to buy them, I'm going to be there, and I'll sign the book for you. And it's going to be down in the... Well, somebody sit down in the main area down below, the general area. Yes? Yeah. Anyway, thanks very much for coming. I appreciate it, and I'll be around. So if you have any other questions, just stop me, and I'll try to answer them. Thanks very much.